Tax update for July 15th, 2007. This is tax update for July 15th, 2007. Home equity of a different sort, claiming deductions for a home that the taxpayer doesn't own. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the information presented. The podcast and supporting documents may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the supporting podcast. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. This week, we're going to take a look at a court case, the case of Nair versus Commissioner, TC Summary Opinion 2007-116. And we're going to take a look at this case not so much because the result is terribly surprising. I think most practitioners would have presumed Mr. Nair would get the results that Mr. Nair got, at least on most of the issues in question. What is interesting, though, is the tax court's discussion of how, had the facts been somewhat different, the result could have been somewhat different. And tax practitioners may want to look at the exact situation in which the facts would have gone into Mr. Nair's favor. Now, the case in question dealt with Mr. Nair, and Mr. Nair had claimed deductions for interest, property taxes, and a casualty loss on a home which Mr. Nair was not listed as the owner of on the title, nor was he listed as a person under obligation on the mortgage. He had paid for the mortgage payments for at least part of the year in question, and he had attempted to make the claim on his personal tax return for those payments due to the fact that he had advanced funds during the situation in question. However, the tax court eventually held with the IRS that Mr. Nair did not get to take any of the deductions because A, he didn't really own the home, as the tax court determined, and B, because even for those items which he might have owned, he was not able to establish a basis that would allow him to claim a deduction for the casualty loss in question. Now, let's do a quick refresh on the basic background of various expenses that we tend to see as a homeowner that we could take as a deduction on our personal income tax return. Now, we have the ability to deduct interest on the mortgage paid to acquire the home under Section 163 H2 and 3. We have the right to deduct property taxes paid on the property. Under 164, we are allowed a deduction for property taxes that we had paid on the property, and that would include, by the way, any piece of real estate we happen to own, but our home happens to qualify for that. As well, if we experience a casualty loss on our home, we can claim the casualty loss deduction under Section 165, subject, as we're all aware, to the 10% of AGI limitations and the still existent ridiculous $100 floor. Those of you who have been in practice for many years may not remember there was a time when the 10% limitation did not exist, but the $100 floor was there when Congress put in the 10% limitation. For reasons I never quite understood, they didn't remove the $100 floor. So it becomes 10% plus $100 is the level at which you have to rise in order to get a deduction for a casualty loss. Nevertheless, we still have the rule in place. Now, Mr. Nair had claimed deduction for all of these on his personal return for the year in question. And the amounts in question were $2,459 for real estate taxes, $4,418 for home mortgage interest, and $27,127 on a casualty loss. Now, Mr. Nair himself was not listed as an owner of the house if you check the formal title. It was titled in the name of his father and another unrelated individual. As well, Mr. Nair was not named on the mortgage. His father and mother were named as the individuals who had the obligation under the mortgage. Now, the facts did establish that Mr. Nair made at least some of the mortgage payments on the property during the year in question, and that was established by records that Mr. Nair submitted from his bank account that clearly indicated he had made the payment on the mortgage in question. Now, this residence suffered a major fire on February 25th of 2003, which is the year in question, 19 days after the insurance policy on the home was canceled due to the non-payment of the insurance premium. That's somewhat bad timing. So it created a significant uninsured loss on the property. The house was basically wiped out in the fire. Mr. Nair claimed a loss of $26,000 on the home. Now, he claimed that was the basis in the home, with the property currently having a fair market value of $112,350 before the fire. And he claimed $6,500 in deductions for losses on personal property, for which he claimed a basis of $7,500. Now, the IRS argued this was all fine and good. They weren't disputing the amounts of the deduction in question. They were disputing in each case the right of Mr. Nair to claim them. And I should say they didn't dispute the amounts for the property taxes and the interest. They did dispute the amounts in the case of the casualty losses, as we'll find out, due to the fact they claimed that Mr. Nair did not show basis documentation for either of those items, regardless of whether he owned them. Let's take a look at each of the items in question and the opinion the tax court gave about why Mr. Nair was not entitled to the deduction for each one. Now, the regulations under Section 163 related to interest generally require that a taxpayer be the owner of the property in order to deduct the interest on the mortgage. However, there is an exception where you could be considered the owner of the property even if you aren't the formal owner on the title. Specifically, Regulation 1.16-1B provides that interest paid by a taxpayer upon real estate of which he is the legal or equitable owner, even though the taxpayer is not directly liable upon the bond or note secured by such mortgage, may be deducted as interest on his indebtedness. So note, the regulations specifically state that it is not the requirement that you be on the title for the property, that you be listed as the official legal owner, nor even that you be listed as the person obligated on the mortgage in order to get a home mortgage interest deduction. So the mere fact that Mr. Nair was neither one of those did not by itself make the case a slam dunk. Mr. Nair still had an option under which he could bring this deduction back in as deductible. The tax court discussed what Mr. Nair would have to have done in order to bring it in under these rules. And the court notes essentially that state law is what we have to reference when we're going to determine if someone is the equitable owner of the property. Remember, we had no question that Mr. Nair was not listed as the official owner on the title or the legal owner, so the question becomes, was he the equitable owner? And the tax court notes that we're going to be dealing with the state law. In this case, the state law is the law of the state of New York. And generally, the court held that under the New York law, a purchaser of property becomes the equitable owner upon entering into a contract for the sale of property. And the tax court cites a couple of New York state cases to back up the proposition that this is the requirement under New York state law. Now, the court noted that Mr. Nair did not offer any evidence that he had entered into an agreement with his father or the other owner on the title that were listed on the title of the house that would have granted him such an ownership interest. In essence, there was no sale document on the side where Mr. Nair had agreed to purchase the property from his father and the other owner. As well, the tax court notes there is a second way that the court has allowed taxpayers to claim deductions for home mortgage interest. And citing the cases of Trans versus Commissioner, TC Memo 1999-233, and Usula versus Commissioner, TC Memo 1997-551, the taxpayer notes that if a taxpayer has a relative who acquires the property and gets the mortgage as an accommodation to the taxpayer, the fact pattern normally being that due to bad credit, the taxpayer could not qualify for the mortgage on his own, but his relative, who is financially better off, could qualify for the mortgage. So if that relative obtains the property and obtains the mortgage as an accommodation for the taxpayer, in the cases of Trans and Usula, the tax court allowed the individual to claim a deduction for the home mortgage interest. Now, the tax court noted that, in essence, in those two cases, the taxpayers lived in the houses, made all the mortgage payments, and paid all the other expenses for maintenance and down payments. In addition, the taxpayer in Trans, and I should say for maintenance and improvements, in addition, the taxpayer in Trans actually made, they were the ones that advanced the money for the down payment. It was not their relatives who made the down payment. Now, the court notes that Mr. Nair's situation is not similar. The court notes that in this case, the petitioner, meaning Mr. Nair, had not offered evidence that the benefits and burdens he had from the Bronx house rose to the level accepted by the court in those two cases. Now, he had made payments related to the house on behalf of his parents, whom he testified were his dependents and had no bank accounts. And apparently, because they forgot to pay the premium on the mortgage, also seemed to be in somewhat financial straits at the time. Petitioner's bank statements, it goes on to note, show that he made only 8 mortgage payments and none before May of 2003. Now, that's interesting because remember the fire was in February of 2003. We have no evidence, the court notes, to support the claim he paid the premiums on the insurance policy covering the house. Well, apparently he missed at least one that we needed to get paid. The record is also unclear as to what extent he even lived in the house. Overall, the court notes, we cannot say the petitioner's actions with respect to the house indicate that he treated the home as his own or that he intended to have the full benefits and burdens of ownership. It would appear more likely, given that he began to pay for this house after the fire, and those were the payments he could document, and we understand that his parents were his dependents. His parents, we don't know for sure, but given the fact that the insurance policy lapsed, it would appear that it would not be unreasonable to presume that financially they probably weren't in the best of shape. And the fact that their house burned down now in an uninsured manner and they now needed a place to live, plus had this liability now still outstanding to pay the debt on the mortgage, put them in extreme financial hurt. And Mr. Nair basically ended up just advancing the money to keep his parents from essentially defaulting on that mortgage, and to clean up everything and basically, you know, finally resolve the situation, hopefully for his parents. The tax court notes as much. We conclude based on the record that the petitioner made payments on his parents' mortgage merely as a way to provide support for them. While admirable, this moral obligation to support his parents does not entitle him to deduct the mortgage interest. In essence, Mr. Nair was being a good son, but Mr. Nair did not, therefore, get the right to claim the deduction for the expenses he had paid on behalf of his parents. Now, this is a fact pattern that we actually sometimes see also for parents who attempt to bail out their kids. I've had parents approach me more than once wondering if, well, I went ahead and I took over paying mortgage payments because my son was, you know, laid off, or my son ran into financial difficulties, and so, you know, I've actually paying for that, and I get to deduct that right as a second residence. Well, like the Nair case, the answer is almost certainly not. If they aren't treating that as their home, if they don't have the burdens and benefits of ownership, you're going to have a problem. And frankly, in this particular case, it would appear that it seems highly unlikely in a fact pattern like that, with somebody temporarily paying expenses just to bail someone out of a financial bind, that they actually have basically treated that as their residence. Rather, they're simply providing support. Now, real estate taxes for property is allowed under Section 164A1, which provides that basically, except as otherwise provided in that section, that you are allowed a deduction for state, local, and foreign real property taxes. However, Regulation 1.164-1A provides in part that in general, the taxes are deductible only by the person upon whom they are imposed. And as you might expect, those taxes are imposed on the owner of the property. The court noted that for taxes, the same equity concept would apply. However, as they note, Mr. Nair wasn't the equitable owner, so he's not going to get the taxes for the same reason. He basically lost out and did not get the tax deduction. Finally, we consider the casualty loss. Remember, the house suffered a significant fire that it would appear from the court opinion either totally wiped out or came awfully close to wiping out the house. Casualty losses are allowed as a deduction under the general loss provisions under Section 165A. Now, Section 165A, the broad rule, provides there's a deduction for any loss sustained during a taxable year and not compensated for by insurance or otherwise. So the general rule is, and this is important to remember under Section 165, there is a broad loss allowance rule. All losses are allowable. Now, since we all know that doesn't really happen, as you might guess, we're going to hit exceptions here. We're going to hit exceptions both in this section and elsewhere in the Internal Revenue Code that will limit our ability to deduct losses. But for today, we're going to concentrate on the casualty losses, which do fall under this provision. Now, 165B provides the amount of a deduction if you have a Section 165 loss. The basis for determining the deduction for any loss shall be the adjusted basis provided in Section 1011 for determining the loss from the sale or disposition of the property. Therefore, it's important to note, for purposes of claiming a loss that is going to rely upon Section 165, you have to establish the basis of the property, because that's how you're going to be able, you're going to use that in factoring in the computation of your loss. Now, 165C provides special limitations on 165 losses for individuals. For an individual taxpayer, only three classes of losses fall under Section 165. And those are losses incurred in a trade or business. Second is losses incurred in any transaction entered into for profit, though not connected with a trade or business. And, except as provided in Section H, losses of property not connected with a trade or business or a transaction entered into for profit, if such losses arise from fire, storm, shipwreck, or other casualty, or from theft. Now, it's important to note under 165C that basically you go down this list of three ways to look at the loss, and you stop at the first one that applies. Therefore, business casualty losses will come under 165C1, the loss incurred in a trade or business, not under 165C3, because we've already got the deduction under C1, and C3 just allows losses that would not otherwise qualify but are casualty losses. Now, special rules for the treatment of casualty losses are found in Section 165H for the personal casualty losses, and that's where we find at H1 the continued existence of the $100 floor. At H2, we find the 10% limitation on AGI, and we have a number of definitions and special rules that apply to casualty losses further down in the H section. Now, Mr. Nair's issues didn't really deal with all the interesting parts of Section 165H, so I'll leave that in the materials that we have this week, but I'm not going to go into it in detail in the podcast. Rather, with regard to real estate, he faced the basic problem on the real property that he wasn't the owner. The tax court note that inherent in Section 165 is a requirement to claim a deduction for loss of property. The taxpayer must have been the owner of the property at the time of the loss, and the tax court cites Draper versus Commissioner from 1950 and Miller versus Commissioner in 1975 tax court memo case. If the taxpayer is not the owner of the property, the taxpayer generally cannot claim a deduction for casualty loss related to that property. This time citing Blanche versus Commissioner and Wayno versus Commissioner. In our discussion regarding the mortgage interest deduction, we held that the petitioner had no legal or equitable ownership in the Bronx Boulevard house during 2003 when the fire loss occurred. Therefore, it should not be surprising that he had a problem right out of the chute on the real property. He wasn't the owner. Therefore, regardless of anything else, he couldn't claim the loss. But the IRS had a second objection, which the tax court agreed also would have prevented the deduction even if Mr. Nair had been the equitable owner. The tax court notes, in addition, in order to determine the entitlement to a casualty loss deduction, a taxpayer's basis in the damaged or destroyed property must be known. Where a taxpayer fails to prove his basis, we are unable to determine the amount of loss that is deductible. And again, citing the cases of Zamuda versus Commissioner from 1982, Millsap versus Commissioner from 1966, and the Regulation 1.165-1C. The tax court notes Mr. Nair has not proven any tax basis in the Bronx house. He stated a basis of $26,000 but offered no evidence in support of it. That issue would have apparently by itself served to disallow his deduction on the house. Now, the basis issue came back to haunt Mr. Nair as well when we looked at the personal property. Now, the personal property, there's no recorded title, so we don't have the problem that he was not the recorded owner of the property. So the issue on the personal property was, well, the house didn't really dispose of that. We still could have had personal property that was destroyed in the fire. Fire doesn't stop to check to see who the owner is of each piece of property. It just keeps moving on through the property in question. However, the court noted, turning to his personal property destroying the house, he had not adequately proven his entitlement to the deduction. The only documentation that Mr. Nair actually provided in this case was a list of property allegedly destroyed along with the dollar amounts representing the value he assigned each item. The tax court found two flaws with this list. First, it does not substantiate the loss of the personal property. All it says is he claims it was in there. Nor does it establish his tax basis in the property. Therefore, the tax court held that he may not deduct any amount for the loss of personal property in the Bronx Boulevard house fire. Now, technically, you may note, you might think your clients and even yourself might have a little problem here. You know, could you establish the existence and the basis for personal property if it was destroyed in the fire? Now, honestly, I would suspect the tax court was a little more, shall we say, not sympathetic in this case, because they seemed to indicate they had no reason to believe that Mr. Nared actually lived in the house. And if you're not living in the house, it seems unlikely you stored a lot of personal property in the house. That probably was in the place you were living. But secondly, it is important to note that basis is an issue in casualty loss cases. And it is an issue, by the way, normally with your insurance company as well. So it might not be a bad idea, both personally and from the standpoint of documenting a casualty loss in case you have uninsured losses, to consider how to obtain and how to make documentation for what actually exists in a location if it is destroyed by fire or burglarized or otherwise incurs a casualty loss. Because as the tax court noted in this case, the requirement to document that information is part of the regulations and part of the requirement to claim your loss under Section 165. Now, the case, as I noted when we started this, is hardly surprising for its results. I think most practitioners would have believed Mr. Nair was going to lose this one. In fact, most practitioners would have probably told Mr. Nair right off he didn't have a chance on this one, and it probably makes sense as to why Mr. Nair was not represented by counsel in this case, because most counsel would have told him the best thing to do is cut your losses and go home. But Mr. Nair basically soldiered on and got to tax court and lost on all issues. But the case is interesting, and its analysis is one you may want to look at when you have clients who may be in a position of being able to really claim equitable ownership. As well, it may be a case to be instructive if you have a client who has a potential casualty loss situation, and you're looking at the issue of what the taxpayer should have as documentation to be able to be fairly certain that you could sustain the deduction for the casualty loss. By the way, tying this back into our 6662 discussion, or 6662 and 6694A discussion that we've had in recent weeks on penalties, remember the regulations are the ones that talk about the requirements in many of these areas for the documentation needs to be there, and the code provides the basis limitation. To the extent you're going contrary to a regulation, obviously you have a disclosure problem no matter what. But even if you're not contrary to the regulation, you believe you have enough evidence to establish basis, you may still have issues of discussing whether you've met the more likely than not standard. Remember, with a casualty loss that is going to be deductible, we're almost always dealing in a personal casualty loss situation with a significant loss, not just a small one. The numbers will be big enough that taxpayers and their advisors may do well to review the penalty provisions and consider the potential issues that they might face if the IRS were to determine there was not sufficient evidence backing up the claim deduction to sustain the loss. Again, the new change penalties are going to change the way we look at certain cases, including these, I believe. Now, this has been the tax update for the week of July the 15th, 2007. As I noted last couple of weeks, I am getting ready for a couple of CPE presentations coming up in Phoenix on the 27th on the tax practice and ethics presentation. Two presentations in New York, Westchester, New York, actually Rye, New York. Coming up there at the 2nd and 3rd of August. And I'm getting ready to go to Casper, Wyoming for presentations on the 16th and 17th of August in Casper, Wyoming. So if you're going to be around any of those locations, I would look forward to seeing you and having you sign up for the courses. Contact the state CPA societies in question for signing up for the courses. I'm going to be doing some prep work for all of that here in the near future, so I'm going to be coming in and out doing some things, but hopefully we can keep the podcast all up and running and going like normal. And again, the Tax Update podcast is brought to you by Leinberg Information Services, located on the web at www.leinbergservices.com. Go ahead and visit Steve's site for items of interest to tax practitioners. Just this past week, there is an article discussing a recent estate tax case, which may be instructive regarding the SSVS number one issue we discussed basically back on the July 4th podcast, where we were talking about issues where you have publicly traded stock, but you may still trigger the valuation standards. In the case discussed in the Leinberg newsletter by Paul Hood, you have the exact fact pattern that would invoke SSVS number one on a CPA practitioner. So those of you who subscribe to Lineberg Services, you may want to go back and look at that case, both from what it gives you in terms of valuing stock that is subject to restriction under SEC rules, but also the issue about how SSVS number one may enter into cases like that if you have a client who has that type of stock and the value of that stock becomes a matter of interest. This has been the Tax Update Podcast.